firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Okay, this month on Fire Marshal's Corner, we have a big change happening here. Mike Love is going to be joining me as a regular co-host on the show, and thanks for raising your hand and volunteering, Mike.
Yes, it's certainly my pleasure, and of course, I had the opportunity this past summer at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore to do a on-scene podcast with public educators, and I really had a good time, and so certainly look forward to what we're going to do in the future. And just some background, again, my name is Mike Love, and I'm a fire marshal in Montgomery County, Maryland, and been around the fire service for almost 40 years and as a career firefighter for 33. So this is quite a highlight in the end of the career here.
Well, Mike's going to be a great addition. He has a wealth of experience and knowledge, and for those of you that may not know, Mike is the brains behind eParade. It's that online communication tool that we all use pretty extensively to keep up on what's happening in the fire world and fire safety. And it was all Mike's idea, and he brought that along. And I think, how many members are we up to now, Mike? Have you looked lately at all?
It's close to 900. It kind of wavers between 850 and 900 for the last couple months.
Incredibly active communications tool, but incredibly valuable one too, that we've all just been able to share information, get information, and learn a lot more about what's going on in the world out there because of eParade. So, hats off to Mike for making that happen. I think it's been one of the best things that's really happened when it comes to fire safety in terms of just bringing us all together across the nation. So that's it. Let's just do a quick overview of what we're going to be doing for this month's show on Fire Marshal's Corner. We're going to be talking to Ken LaSala, who's from the National Association of Fire Chiefs. He's going to give us an overview on the Fire and Safer Grants, which the legislation passed the House of Representatives in Washington, now moves on to the Senate. So we have a quick talk with him. He gives a little bit of update on that. Then we have another segment that's going to be looking at fire safety and the environment with Bob Davidson and Dom Kazmauskas. They're going to be giving some updates on what's happening with the International Green Construction Code and some of the other things happening out there to try to raise awareness of the interaction between fire safety and the environment. And then we're going to be wrapping up with a talk with Jim Crawford, who's a project manager for Vision 2020, and he's going to give us an update on what's happening there, and there is a lot happening with that whole project. It has just really taken off, and Jim's going to have a lot of information for us at the end of the show there. So stick with us right here on Fire Marshal's Corner. Okay, and joining me now is Ken LaSala, who's the Director of Government Relations and Policy for the International Association of Fire Chiefs. Ken, appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for your time today. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, inform your listeners about what happened on November 18th. The House of Representatives passed H.R. 3791, the Fire Grants Reauthorization Act. As it sounds like, this bill would reauthorize both the Fire and the Safer Grant programs until the end of fiscal year 2014. Mm-hmm.
Now, some of our people might not be exactly familiar with what those two different grant programs are about. Can you just talk quickly about them?
Sure. The Fire Grant Program is pretty well known. It's the program that's run by DHS, and what it does is it gives funds directly to local fire departments for equipment and training and fire prevention activities. Mm-hmm. And probably the hallmark of the Fire Grant Program is the fact that it uses a merit-based peer review process to go through and look at all the applications, rank them, and then DHS uses that peer review process, in which case the actual firefighters are doing the reviewing of the applications. They take the results of that process, and that's how they decide who gets grants, which is a lot different than a lot of the other DHS grant programs. Right. The Safer Grant uses the same process. It gives funding directly to local fire departments, but it funds two activities. One is the hiring of firefighters, and then two is it funds recruitment and retention activities by volunteer fire departments.
And these have both been in place for quite a few years now, haven't they?
Mm-hmm. The Fire Grant originally came, it originally passed in 2000. And I believe the Safer Grant program passed, originated in 2004.
Yeah. And they've been very successful, too, in helping fire departments across the country, you know, improve the staffing on their departments and also a lot of the fire prevention activities and equipment as well.
Sure.
But there are some changes that were made this year. I understand some amendments were offered on the program, and some changes were made before it went in there that made it this year just a little bit different.
Yep, we actually made a number of different changes, and what I'd just like to make clear is the fact that the this Fire Grants Reauthorization Act is actually a product of a lot of hard work among the fire service. All the major stakeholders got together to put together this legislation. It was a group effort that was agreed to, and a compromise was worked out amongst, obviously, the International Association of Fire Chiefs, who I represent, the International Association of Firefighters, and the National Volunteer Fire Council, and the National Fire Protection Association. And also, this was all done under the auspices, obviously, of the Congressional Fire Service Institute. And you know, what we ended up doing is it probably took us about a year to get an agreement and to work out, for everybody to sit down, work out what the different improvements that each organization saw were necessary. And we were able to put together a pretty good compromise. And then we were fortunate in the fact that, we worked with the House Science and Technology Committee, the chairman, Bart Gordon, and then the subcommittee chairman, David Wu. We worked with the Congressional Fire Caucus. Steny Hoyer and Peter King and Joanne Emerson and Rob Andrews. We managed to put together a pretty good bill. And just to go into some of the details, probably the biggest changes were with the fire grant program. And what we did is, using the amount of money that's appropriated every year, we kind of broke out different percentages of how that appropriated funding would be allocated. So basically, you're starting off with 100% funding for the program. 3% of the appropriated funds goes to fire service training academies, and then 2% goes to volunteer non-fire service EMS and rescue.
Okay. Now, I understand something new was put into this bill this year, too, about creating centers of excellence to help with some information transfer.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. That's actually something that the IFC has been advocating for. Basically, we think there's a lot of good research being done out there, especially through the fire prevention and safety grants and a lot of your major universities or state universities around the country. And our concern is that this research really isn't making it out into the mainstream fire service. So something which we are proposing, which Congress is considering, is setting up these fire safety research centers. And what they would be is partnerships between major fire service or fire safety organizations and major universities. And basically, the universities can do the research, and then the fire service organizations have the apparatus and the ability to get this research out to the fire service. Like, for example, if the IFC was partnering with someone like the University of Maryland and MIFRI, and they found some new information on how firefighting leads to cancer, or the relationship between cancer and firefighting, then what we could do is we could take that information from the University of Maryland and get it out to our membership through our member alerts, through on-scene, our newsletter, and through our conferences like Fire Rescue Med or Fire Rescue International. So we see it as a good opportunity to get a lot of funding into research, but then making sure that research makes it out into the mainstream fire service.
Now, how much did the House, in the House bill, how much money are they allocating for these programs?
Overall, obviously the fire grant program gets about $1 million, and then $1 billion, and then the Safer Grant program gets roughly about $1.2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
For the fire safety research centers, that funding would come out of the 10% now that's allocated for the fire prevention and safety grants.
Okay. Now, is that an increase or decrease from previous years?
Basically, what we're looking in terms of the overall numbers for the programs, basically they're flat funded or at least the authorization is flat funded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, we've never seen $1 billion for either the fire or the safer grant programs.
Right.
But what we're doing is setting a ceiling for the program, and then we can use that kind of long-term funding ceiling to go back to the appropriations committees and ask them every year to fund the fire and safer grant programs to these authorized levels. And then for the fire prevention and safety grants, basically, again, we're actually doubling the amount of money that can be allocated to the fire prevention and safety grants because we're going from 5% of the appropriated funds to 10% of the appropriated funds.
So what's the next step on the bill?
The next step is the bill, you know, obviously passed the House of Representatives, and now it's going over to the Senate, and there the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee is going to be considering the legislation. Hopefully the committee will be able to take a look at it either at the end of this year, beginning of next year, and then hopefully we can get the bill passed in this Congress.
And who's introduced it on the Senate side?
It has not yet been introduced over on the Senate side.
Okay. All right.
So I know, you know, the Fire Caucus leadership and then also the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee leadership are looking at drafting a bill as we speak.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to fill us in. That was a really great day on Wednesday with passage of this bill. And as we all know, nothing in Congress is a sure thing, but that's just a major step forward. So, you know, thanks for all the hard work that IFC has been doing it along with all the other folks involved with it. I know it's just not, it's really truly a coalition effort putting this stuff together and getting it through. So thanks to IFC and everybody else that's been working on this. And thanks to you, Ken, because I know you put a lot of time on these bills up there.
Thanks, Ed.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Ken LaSala, who's the Director of Government Relations and Policy for the International Association of Fire Chiefs, and we've been talking about the legislation that just passed in the House, providing funding for the Aid to Firefighters grants and the SAFER Act. So there'll be much more on this. There's some links on the page below, some articles about this, if you want to learn more, and we'll keep you up to date as things happen in the future.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
All right. Joining us now, we have Bob Davidson, who's representing National Association of State Fire Marshals on the International Green Construction Code process, and Dom Kazmauskas from the National Fire Sprinkler Association, who's also working on that same project, has been doing a lot of green activity. So thanks for joining us, guys. Let's get into talking about fire safety and the environment and just see what's happening here. I'd like to start with you, Bob. Maybe you can fill us in a little bit on what's happening out there with the International Green Construction Code and what kind of step they're at in the process on that right now.
Well, thank you. One thing I want to point out is that fire safety and Green Construction Code are compatible topics. It's really just a matter of making sure that as we move forward, fire safety doesn't negatively impact their needs, and they don't impact sustainability requirements, don't impact fire safety needs. This Green Construction Code process that the International Code Council has started in partnership with AIA and the Green Building Council is really a major paradigm shift, whereas in the past, everything for sustainability guidelines for building construction has been voluntary. This is really development of a mandatory green construction code that jurisdictions could adopt and enforce to mandate that new buildings meet sustainability goals. It's an interesting process to participate with because you're dealing with people that worked in the code arena for many years and people who worked in sustainability, and you bring two different thought processes together and trying to come out with a finished product. I think it's been going well, but interesting.
Now, there really is no other code out there that addresses green construction. Everything else is voluntary, like the LEED system and things like that. So this will be the first mandatory code on the books, won't it?
Yes, it will. And they have a very aggressive schedule. The process started in July, and they've been meeting regularly around the country besides weekly teleconferences, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, depending on the work groups. They even attempted to keep that up through the regular code hearing process that went on recently in Baltimore for 3 weeks. However, they finally did have to cancel some of the teleconferences because many of us that are involved in the code arena, you know, you're swamped. You're tied up with that code development process. You don't have time to get on a teleconference. But they picked up this week with the communications, the teleconferences. They have a meeting scheduled for December and again in January. They hope to have this document draft out for public comment in March.
And when are they hoping to have it actually on the street as a final document?
With the 2012 series of the I-codes, the tentative schedule right now is that they get it out for public comment in March. The initial co-development hearings would be in August of 2010. Their final action hearings for it would be in September, very quick turnaround, so that they could publish it as part of their 2012 series of international codes, all complementing each other.
Bob, it's Mike.
Sure, go ahead.
In the area of fire protection contractors, what do you see might be a big impact on them as far as transitioning from, you know, our former way of doing business to a new sustainable type of construction?
Presently, as it's moving forward, you're not going to see an impact because at this point in time, they haven't listed fire protection as sustainable or not sustainable. There is a belief out there that providing automatic fire sprinkler systems in a building should be clearly a sustainability positive, because if you keep the building from burning down, you didn't turn it into rubble. It's going to go on for its life expectancy, which is part of the sustainability, and you won't be throwing debris in a landfill releasing all sorts of volatiles during the burning process. However, that hasn't caught on yet. And what's really a part of our participation is working to make sure that this remains an overlay code, that it complements the International Building Code, International Fire Code, instead of conflicting, and that it doesn't supersede existing fire and life safety requirements, which I'm glad to report that everybody involved in the process, sustainability side, code development side, all agree that this code isn't intended to conflict with existing fire and life safety requirements. So for now, I don't see an impact. However, I really think it should be recognized as a positive impact that we provide automatic sprinkler systems.
And I think you bring up an excellent point there, too, that, you know, the green side doesn't really recognize fire as a, or fire safety, rather, as a sustainable component of the sustainability. And, Dom, you came up with a really good example. I think there was a fire, I think it was out in Colorado, was it not?
Yes, there was not a very large facility, and our regional manager that's out there in our Great Plains region, along the areas of the Rockies, he had gone to a fire in Estes Park, Colorado, and, you know, knowing that we were the National Fire Sprinkler Association has an active green committee, we're looking for just any type of information, and he was nice enough to snap quite a handful of pictures of all the discolored water, styrofoam peanuts, and other debris running down into a storm drain in this pristine part of the United States, going down the storm drain and then down into a local creek. They had hazmat diapers out there picking up some of it, but he had pictures, as you can see, the peanuts laying on the rocks all the way downstream, and again, that discolored water where you could tell there was definitely some sort of petroleum product or oil product going right down, you know, right down this beautiful stream in the Rockies.
And, you know, and I'm going to come back in a little bit and talk a little bit more about that and some of the other aspects, especially the FM Global test. But I'd like to kind of flip back to Bob for a minute here. And, you know, you'd mentioned that this is an opportunity for the fire service to get involved in this process and maybe put forward some of the things that we're facing, what are some of the other issues besides sprinklers that you see relating to fire safety in the environment?
Well, I think what the main concern that we have out there in the green world, and it hasn't been a problem with this group because of the open dialogue, but you know, we're in a period of time when everybody recognizes the importance of green products, green construction, sustainability, and what comes along with that are all the snake oil salesmen. You know, people come up with the green ideas, you know, for marketing purposes. This is green, that's green. And just because it's green doesn't mean it necessarily complies with existing codes and provides the appropriate level of safety. That's where I think the big impact is today, fire safety and the fire services, dealing with all these other issues that get marketed over the Internet, et cetera, of green products. NASA itself has recognized the concept that, okay, even if we have a green code, who's providing an interface, guidance, education, and information resource for, yes, that product, it's not only green, but it also meets the current requirements of the codes for fire and life safety. And they have a separate program that they've been provided a grant for to get that type of process off the ground, which is going to be important to code officials. Day to day, they're dealing with people that push green concepts, green ideas. Governing bodies would obviously embrace such an idea, but maybe it doesn't meet code requirements, and needs to be controlled.
And I think one of the biggest things I'm seeing is that just there really isn't much awareness in the fire safety community of this whole thing. And I don't know, Mike, you know, have you heard anything from your peers in terms of fire safety and the environment being kind of a hot-button issue for them?
Well, one of the things that that has come up, of course, over the last year and a half or so is the whole concern about fire retardants, the bromated materials that are put into many different materials to make them less, you know, combustible. And the issue is that in many places in the world, these have been banned because they are carcinogens or they're pervasive in the environment. So, for instance, if something is impregnated, a bromated fire retardant in foam padding for furniture, oftentimes every time somebody sits down on the material, it gives off you know, particles that people breathe, and this material gets you know, into the environment, people are breathing it. But also, if it does catch on fire, it gives off you know, vapors and oils that do accumulate on firefighters' PPE, and they're, you know, not always that careful about decontaminating things after fires. They put it in their car, you know, their kids are exposed to it. So really, this has been an evolving issue in the fire service, but that's one area of fire and life safety that certainly has become a concern, and the environment as well, is the fire retardants.
Dom, I know that you were up at FM Global recently where they did quite the test looking at fire safety environment. Can you kind of fill us in on what that was all about?
The Home Fire Sprinkler Coalition had teamed up with FM Global to conduct scientific tests on determining water usage and the methyl ethyl bad crap that's coming off of structure fires. And it was a well-provided test, and it was obviously revolved around the green issues involving structure fires. And they performed two live burns, one with sprinklers and one without sprinklers, with a mock-up of a fully furnished 15 by 20-foot living rooms. And the initial data that has been released by FM right after the live burns, they let us know that the sprinklered living room compared to the non-sprinklered living room only used 10% of the water. That includes from the fire sprinkler as well as from the fire hoses for a couple of minutes during mop-up operation. And that I believe it was the CO, the carbon monoxide, was 1% of the release in the sprinkler side compared to an unchecked fire being left to burn for 10 minutes.
And I think it was really no surprise that obviously, you know, it takes less water and all that sort of stuff. But I think what this is great at is quantifying all the things that we kind of intuitively know that, you know, gee, less water, less toxic runoff, less gases, off-gassing and everything else. But here's a great opportunity to quantify all that sort of thing when we're trying to make the point that sprinklers and fire safety is really, you know, it is a environmental issue.
Ed, can I make a point just a second?
Yes, sure.
You know, one of the I heard Dom talk about this last spring at the parade conference, and it intrigued me about the carbon contribution that a fire has. And just yesterday, there was an article in the Washington Post on the front page about the emissions from the peat bog fires in Indonesia. And I know that sounds like a far off subject in what we're talking about, but there's so much burning in that they become the third highest contributor to carbon in the atmosphere behind the United States and China. And it's all from fires in the peat. So clearly people are concerned about the emission of carbon into the environment, certainly carbon dioxide. And of course fires contribute to that, and as Dom has applied the link, you know, sprinklers can, you know, reduce the amount of time of burn and the intensity of burn, and so therefore, you know, can help us reach some goals. And there are some out there that say that, you know, in the United States there should be an 80% reduction in those emissions by 2050. That's not official, but that's a goal. So somewhere along the line, we're going to get some recognition for sprinklers in this regard.
Yeah, we definitely need to make that. We need to make that connection with the green community, the people that are driving these codes and the LEED program. They are very astute at following the carbon trail on manufacturing items. They just do not seem to be able to make that leap to follow the carbon trail. That if, you know, what if where these items are going, where these structural elements or interior finishings are going, ends up in a fire. They just do not make that continuing leap. It seems like they feel their job is done once they have measured the carbon released in producing these products, and that's it. That's where the trail ends.
And an interesting approach, too, that's happening over in England. Dr. Jim Marston over there works for one of the fire brigades. And, you know, they're under much stricter requirements than we are to reduce their carbon footprint. And they're actually looking at fire prevention as a mechanism for doing that. And they've done some work to quantify, you know, how much carbon or contribution to the carbon footprint of house fire has. So they're saying that by preventing these fires in the first place, they're reducing their carbon footprint. And they're actually able to hang some numbers off that. So it's not just an intuitive sort of thing. It's hard science, which I think is an excellent approach of, well, if you don't even have the fire in the first place, that's a pretty significant reduction in terms of contributing to the carbon footprint.
Yeah, and a quick review of that, he had done a study. He's a fire protection engineer with the Greater Manchester Fire and Rescue Services in the United Kingdom. And he did an overall study estimating on rubbish fires, brush fires, industrial fires, dwelling fires, and vehicle fires. And their carbon footprint of the year mid-2006 to mid-2007. And he, in quantifying everything, came out with 300,000 metric tons of carbon released in that carbon footprint
and
from unwanted fires.
Yeah, and if we're trying to reduce the carbon footprint, you know, no, I think one of the big problems, like we've been talking about earlier, is really getting the fire service and the fire safety community on board with this whole concept. And Bob was talking about how NASFAM's kind of building that bridge there to try to raise awareness. I mean, I'm going to kind of throw it out to everybody. You know, what can we do to really raise the awareness of the fire service about this? I mean, besides this podcast, you know, we need to do a lot more to get them on board with this concept. And also how it's going to impact them operationally. Because there are going to be some
right.
operational units or operational ideas, such as rooftop photovoltaic units, the green roofs, where you know they're putting landscaping up on the roofs, which is going to have a contributing factor, and things like that. Kind of throwing it out there. Any ideas, guys?
Well, this is Bob Davidson. you know, we have interest in the topics. We did get a green roof, a significant green roof code change through this cycle, requiring standpipes be up to the roof level if the standpipes already exist in a building, requiring 6-foot clearance around the green roof areas, and any exposed roofing be Class A, as well as maximum dimensions 125 feet by 125 feet. So we got that through, and we had a good discussion on a photovoltaic proposal that took a guideline out of the California State Fire Marshal's office and turned it into code language, and that got defeated, but not because they didn't agree with it. In fact, there was strong encouragement to refine it and bring it back. I think what we're struggling against is time. The ability of the fire service to address all the impacts on our services. We're going through a cycle where people are fighting to keep manpower, losing manpower, and yet when we have economic downturns, we definitely have an increase in demand on fire responses and dealing with properties that aren't maintained. So I think it's not one of interest. I think it's one of they have to focus. They just can't keep track of it all. And those of us that participate in the co-development cycle, you know, I'm sure Mike and Don agree with this, that it's really, when you look at the code development, the international codes and some significant stuff with the NFPA standards, it's a core group of people to participate in the International Code Council process and then also try to participate in NFPA. It's not a lot of people. If I was to refer to it as a handful out of the fire service that actually have the time and ability to try and pay attention and actually participate, I think that's an accurate statement. Mike, Don, your opinions?
Oh, without a doubt.
I agree.
And of course, you know, the whole effort to get sprinklers into the or keep sprinklers in the International Residential Code, you know, we had to go out and promote this to the fire service, get them there. Many of them had never been exposed to the process. So yeah, I agree, it's a handful, and we have to expand that, as well as, I think, you know, more and more writing in periodicals and in blogs and that kind of thing to get the word out. People get interested, but they just haven't been exposed to it that much.
Well, we've been talking about fire safety and the environment, which is becoming a growing awareness in the fire service, so we certainly need more of that. And I think what's really jump-starting it is the International Green Construction Code process that both Bob and Dom are involved with, along with Ken Krause, who's representing the International Association of Fire Chiefs Fire and Life Safety Section. He's participating in that process as well. So we certainly need more fire service and fire safety involvement in that, but I really appreciate you guys being there to kind of monitor what's going on and be on the leading edge of it, really, because if you hadn't been there, I think there are a few things that probably would have happened that would not have been in our interest. So I really appreciate you guys being there and carrying the water for everybody on this. So we've been talking with Bob Davidson, who's representing the National Association of State Fire Marshals on the International Green Construction Code, and Dom Kasmauskas from the National Fire Sprinkler Association, and we've been talking about fire safety and the environment. So there's a lot more on this. Look below on the webpage. You'll see some links to some other material that's out there, and we'll be having more on this in future podcasts. So thanks for joining us. Okay, now we're talking with Jim Crawford, who's the project manager for Vision 2020. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
You bet. My pleasure.
A lot's happening in Vision 2020 project. There's no two ways about it. So we asked Jim here to give us an update on it, and maybe you can tell us what some of the latest and greatest is about the project.
Well, I'd be happy to, Ed. Actually, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you guys about this. There is a lot going on, and I guess I'd start with an overview of the project as a whole. And if it's okay with you, I'd go into each one of the five strategies itself. Does that work for you?
Sure.
Well, overall, we've received funding for another cycle. This is more significant than last year. Last year's grant basically was kind of a bridge, for lack of a better way to describe it, to keep some of the core functions of Vision 2020 moving forward and to make some additional progress on what has become part of the core project, and that's model performance measures for prevention programs. And overall, the new grant, we're still working out the details with the grant folks and the U.S. Fire Administration, and I think that this is significant, on what the details of a cooperative agreement would be. Both the Fire Administration and the feds have an interest in model performance measures, in model prevention programs, in clearinghouse for those, and the new grant allows us to do more substantive work in that regard. It's also going to allow us to have a major symposium, much as we did the first time around with Vision 2020, with a slightly different twist. And that is that we'll be allowed enough funding to bring at least one representative in from each state to review not only model performance measures, but to learn from some model performance programs that are operating in the field. To be honest, we're still refining the criteria of what defines a model program, because we are finding that one of our first concerns is it's model because you've evaluated it, you're able to demonstrate some impacts or outcomes for your programs. And actually, there are some programs out there that do that, but we're just not aware of too many. So we're in the process of refining the criteria, identifying those programs, and having what is called a model prevention program symposium, tentatively scheduled for late June of 2010 in the Washington, D.C. area. We're trying to tie this into to the parade planning that's occurring. And the bottom line is, under this cooperative agreement, it now allows substantial involvement by both the grant office and the Fire Administration in these outcome areas of common interest, and outcome being promoting model prevention measures, promoting model programs, and even beginning discussions with the Fire Administration and Sandy Fasinoli about how we might expand the clearinghouse concept with them, clearinghouse of model programs. You'll notice, Ed, that, and Mike, that we're talking about model programs as opposed to best practices, given the level of sophistication that we in the fire prevention community have in documenting the impacts and outcomes of our programs. So we're kind of at the beginning stages. And the final piece of this overall update is that symposium has two other elements to it. And one is that we are planning for and allowing for additional people to participate, self-funded. Knowing how difficult that can be under the current economic climate, we're hoping that many of our local partners who've stepped up to help in the past, and in a lot of cases that's state prevention associations around the country, will be actively involved, will fund participants to come to this two-day symposium in June. And from that, we can not only learn about model programs, but we can revisit the five strategies and talk about where we are now and where we need to go in the future. I hope that's making some sense.
Now, I think that's great information. And now, underneath Vision 2020, when we had that symposium 2 years ago, five strategies were identified, and they've been broken out into working groups and a leader for each working group. Is there any update on each of the strategies?
Yes, if it's okay, I'll take them one at a time.
Sounds like a good idea.
And in order of number, not importance. I think it's very important to let people know that because we numbered them 1 through 5, we were very clear to say that one is not necessarily more important than another. But to begin with strategy one, that was the one where the group talked about, and this is no surprise, what we really need to do is to advocate for prevention programs externally of the fire service. There are decision makers, stakeholders, you know, elected officials from around the nation who need to understand the nature of the fire problem and how important prevention is in the grand scheme of things in dealing with that with the nation's fire problem. I should say the nation's at the state level, at the local level. And so we have received funding in this round through the Institution of Fire Engineers and the Fire Act grant funds to actually develop an advocacy toolkit. We are basing it in large part on information that is already available. And Richard Taylor from the state of Maine State Fire Marshal's Office some other very talented folks are coming together to help us identify how we could portray the nation's fire problem and the importance of prevention in resolving that problem. And here's a concrete example. A lot of times we talk about 3,500 deaths in the nation, and that is, in fact, a national tragedy. But it doesn't garner, now this is my opinion, if you will, it doesn't garner as much attention from policymakers when you compare it with, say, 6 million people a year dying of heart disease. I think, and this is something that Ozzie Murkoff pointed out as well some time ago, that if we talk about the economic losses that we're experiencing from fire, we can make more headway with gathering a decision maker's attention about the level of importance and the level of national and state and local resources that should be devoted to prevention. And if we do it right, at the end of the day, we not only have an advocacy toolkit that can be used nationally to promote prevention as a solution, as a part of the solution to the fire problem, it is a template that people can cut and paste their own information in locally and use it at that level too. And that advocacy toolkit will be developed and kicked off at the Model Prevention Program Symposium in June. So that program is funded, and a small group of people coming together under the champion, which is, for lack of a better way to describe it, the person who stepped up to the plate and said, we'll take this one on, and that was Alan Perdue, as you know very well, and the International Association of Fire Chiefs Fire and Life Safety Section. And the typical process is one or more people will take a leadership role. But being true to the collaborative nature of Vision 2020, there's going to be a variety of organizations invited. And, again, if we do it right, all of the volunteers that are out in the community who stepped up and said, I'd really like to help with this piece.
All right. All right, well, moving on. Strategy 2.
Strategy 2 did not receive a grant application this last round. We applied for AFG grant funds specifically for Strategy 2. That was the one that dealt with a national public education / social marketing campaign. And those who've been paying close attention know that there was kind of a two-pronged approach. One is that we needed a national theme under which everyone could start hanging individual specific prevention messages. And really the only example that I can think of, and I overuse it, I'm afraid, is only you can prevent forest fires was a very powerful message that's lasted since shortly after World War II, if my memory serves correctly. And once we capture people's attention with a theme, then we could have any number of individual prevention messages about fire sprinklers or smoke alarms or kitchen safety or candle safety, how to prevent the structural fires. So Strategy 2 is really about, can we develop a common theme that a variety of partners can participate and adopt so that we start reinforcing that message across a great many organizational efforts? And the other is an emphasis on smoke alarms and being very careful how we do that. We do not subscribe to the home builder's opinion that smoke alarms are enough, so we want to be very careful to say that smoke alarms are an important part of the equation, but fire sprinklers are as well, especially for long-term protection strategies in the U.S. So it's kind of a challenge, and especially so since we haven't received funding. But we did apply this latest go-around, we meaning the Academy for Educational Development, which is one of the partners of this collaborative effort that we now call Vision 2020. We're waiting word on that, and we are also trying to refine the grant application so that we can pursue private sector funding. I'm hopeful that we can get around some of the issues regarding the rules of separation of church and state, if you will, between the grant programs and the fire administration, because personally I think the fire administration could and should play a very important role, especially in Strategy 2, with the resources that they put into it. But we're basically just trying our best to move forward on that one. We'll see if we get funding for it.
Hey, Jim. In Strategy 2, with the gap in funding there this year, how can you keep some momentum going there, even though you don't have the ability to, apply any resources to it?
Well, it isn't, Mike, that there aren't any resources. There is a small amount in the core grant that's run through the Institution of Fire Engineers to bring some key players together and to try and refine the grant application. So, for example, we could go for private sector funding and to try and sort out some of the issues that are involved with how do we get over the rules between the fire administration and the grant folks. I'm sorry to be so vague, but there's a little bit of money to provide some time and resource to moving that effort forward, to assisting Academy for Educational Development and the other partners like Home Safety Council and NFPA and potentially the fire administration to move forward, and including funding for basically a tactical meeting where we could take the grant application and refine it for other purposes. So does that answer your question? There's a little bit of money. Not enough to pull it off.
We're not going to have inertia. It's just that we're not going to get as far as we'd want to.
Precisely.
Right. Okay.
And that's been the danger for all of these, Mike and Ed, as you guys well know. It's one thing to put it on paper. It's another to make action happen, and that requires funding. So I'm pleased that we've been able to make action happen on a variety of these. Strategy 2 is still kind of hanging out there a little bit.
Strategy 3, raise the importance of fire prevention within the fire service. I know there's been a lot of activity in that area going on right now.
There is, actually, and here's another one of the beauties of a collaborative approach. Early on, Bill Kehoe from the Institution of Fire Engineers stepped up and said, I will champion that that strategy. And also early on, Chief Ron Sarnicky from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation stepped up and said, I'm willing to help you. And they've actually spent some of their own money because they recognize the importance of prevention, increasing the level of importance of prevention within the community, because if you have less fires, you're going to have less risk when it comes to firefighter injuries and deaths. And I just want to say publicly that I really appreciate the heart and passion that both Bill and Chief Sarnicky have put into this effort. So they've done some things independently without grant funding, really, to speak of. And they are continuing. So I believe that the National Fallen Firefighters have gotten funding this cycle to do some additional work on understanding how training programs work for firefighters, what is out there now, what is working best with regard to including prevention as one of the core functions of fire service operations. They're kind of moving down that road. Meanwhile, the Washington State Association of Fire Marshals applied for a grant really on behalf of a coalition of organizations who have a passion about this particular topic and three pilot sites, Vancouver, Washington, where I work as fire marshal being one of them, Portland, Oregon, Dallas, Texas, and we've been able to add Wilmington, North Carolina. Frank Blackley has been partnering with us on that as well, and that is more along the lines of what Phil Shainman and Mick Ballesteros were talking with us about, examples that occurred in other countries, the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Australia, et cetera, where we've got funding, some significant funding, to do some demonstration projects, if you will, in those four locations to talk about the other side of the coin, and that's implementation of firefighter-based, I will call it integrated risk management efforts. And the reason I say that is because somebody pointed out to me, Steve Nash actually, saying, you know, you can't really call it prevention because that's not what firefighters get jazzed about. And that's part of the research that needs to be done, is about how best to do this, how best to approach it. On the other hand, we're actually doing it in a few areas, and we have applied for grant funds to expand that into more departments around the country. So if you combine those two efforts, meaning what's happening in the pilot cities and what's happening on the national level, actually Bill Kehoe is kind of at the center of both of those pieces and keeping them tied together. So we're hopeful to be able to demonstrate significant results out of that within the confines of the grant process, which is a year, but others committed to longer term. And the Center for Disease Control is working with us on those projects as well, because they want to look at it long term, How successful are we at institutionalizing these efforts within the fire service is a longer challenge. So that's what's happening with Strategy 3.
Okay, Jim, why don't you move to Strategy 4 then, promote technology to enhance fire and life safety.
Okay, Strategy 4 is moving forward really under its own power. Dan Madrikowski from National Institute of Standards and Technology volunteered to step up and provide leadership for that particular effort. And they have already held one national level, I don't know whether to call it a summit or a symposium, but Dan brought some folks together, even when we didn't have funding through the grant program, to start talking about what's next on the technological horizon. And they decided to focus on kitchen problems, kitchen fires, because it's such a large part of the national fire problem. And they did some initial research that talked about, let's evaluate the effectiveness of suppression systems on kitchen fires. And I'm not the expert that Dan is, but I think doing justice to a summary, it's there are some suppression systems that work far better than others, sprinklers being probably the best because they will operate and continue to operate. But we recognize, and the insurance industry is recognizing, that, yes, a sprinkler system or a fire suppression system of some type can put the fire out, but it's also going to leave one heck of a mess that still costs a lot of money to clean up. So Dan is actually working with us and a variety of other partners. He's leading the way in this regard, but the insurance industry, State Farm Insurance, has allocated a small amount of money because of their interest in the topic, and another symposium is being put together of a variety of partners, including kitchen appliance manufacturers, in the D.C. area in February for the group to talk about how could we evaluate or what's necessary to evaluate technology that might prevent the fires from occurring in the first place. That's going to look at a wide variety, everything from pioneering technologies, safety element, to some examples that Phil Shainman pointed out that work in Sweden and Japan, motion sensors, timers, induction technology on certain kinds of stovetops. So there's a wide variety of technology that will be looked at, and the outcome of that symposium should be what kind of research do we need to validate what is going to work the best. And I'm hopeful that when we're done with that symposium, some research occurs independently, as it has already, and that we point the fire service in a productive direction about what would probably work best at from a technological standpoint of preventing kitchen fires. It's not to take away from the public education messages at all, but in this particular aspect, in this strategy, looking at the technical piece, and there's a small amount of funding in this year's grant through IFE to support that, combined with those private sector dollars. I'm hopeful that we'll have some good results by the time that symposium is done. So that's what's happening with Strategy 4.
Well, and I think that Dan was right on target when he chose, and certainly was after some analysis, to start to focus on cooking, since as you mentioned, such a big chunk of the fire problem is kitchen and cooking related. So if you drill down from there and start looking at the technology that's available in the kitchen at the consumer level, there isn't much out there, and I think it kind of goes back to that whole residential sprinkler issue, is that you have the chicken egg syndrome there. Until there's a demand for it, oftentimes industry is not going to be interested in it because they want to make some money. The other problem that I know Dan had found in that is that standards that are developed by Underwriters Lab really were focused more on commercial-type kitchen appliances and so on that really doesn't transfer over to the consumer level. Mm-hmm. So some of those kind of things had to change.
Right. Well, it's an opportunity, Mike, for us to focus on that. And, you know, in that mix somewhere is concern on the part of the manufacturers that say, you know, you still have to be able to cook as fast and as hot as you ever did before. So how do you meet their needs and prevent a fire from happening is a significant challenge, and one that I hope that we're able to talk about at this technology symposium.
Yeah, well, that's an important one area there, so we'll be looking forward to seeing that. Now, how about let's move on to strategy five, which is refining and improving the application of codes and standards.
Well, we have a little bit of funding to help with strategy five, and here's I'm going to offer my opinion in this. I say that because we haven't really vetted a lot of this through the steering committee, and we do have funding for another steering committee meeting. So part of it is my opinion and. Part of it is just the natural course of evolution for each one of these. But Sean DeCrane, who's battalion chief in Cleveland and representing the International Association of Firefighters as a steering committee member for Vision 2020, stepped up and said, I really have a passion for this issue and I want to help provide some leadership. And what came out of Vision 2020, the forum, was basically, you know, we need to collaborate on these. Codes and standards development, the fire service needs to come together, and that includes the National Association of State Fire Marshals, the International Fire Marshals Association, the IHE's Fire and Life Safety Section, and other partners, because we've got the two playgrounds to work in, that's International Code Council and NFPA. So how can we best mobilize our issues? And this many people would agree with, but I'm saying from where I sit, what Ronnie Coleman did and Jeff Shapiro did for the International Residential Code Fire Sprinkler Coalition is kind of a poster child for how the various groups can cooperate when we identify a clear priority and we get behind it. And so from Vision 2020 standpoint, it really didn't come out as a priority because we were focused on the gaps. And we thought at that point that you know, sprinklers were pretty well taken care of themselves, so what else should we put our efforts into? And we didn't really know, nor did we address the fact at that forum a couple of years back that, yeah, we would be successful, and that's a major accomplishment, I need to say, in both Minneapolis and then here recently in Baltimore, and making sure that fire sprinklers stayed within the model code on the ICC side. It's been within NFPA's code system for some time. So that accomplishment is great, but as people also know, the home builders and others are battling this requirement state by state, sometimes even local jurisdiction by local jurisdiction. So the emphasis on sprinklers is far from being taken care of. And so to combine those efforts, what we are talking about is a relatively small planning symposium, again, funding through the Corps IFE grant for strategy five leaders, some potential partners to come together and talk about what's next. Is there a next big thing on the national horizon that we should come together and support? Something like engineered wood products. Is that the next, you know, big thing that we need to focus on collectively? Or is the battle really at the state and local level? And should we be providing our collective emphasis to support that, recognizing that there's a significant amount of work already being done in that regard, both by the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition and by NFPA, putting a lot of resources into that local advocacy piece, and, of course, the longstanding efforts for the Home Fire Sprinkler Coalition and others who've been promoting that. The point of this summit is to take the documents from Vision 2020 and refine them more into action and identify what kind of funding is going to be necessary to move that forward. So that is tentatively scheduled for February in Arizona. Arizona Fire Marshals Association are stepping up to help us in that regard. Knox Company is providing some free space for us to meet in. So, again, true to kind of Vision 2020's collaborative approach, we're going to try and get a small group of folks together and problem solve on where we need to go next. So that's what's happening with Strategy 5.
Well, that thank you for that update. And you know, the one whole area, and of course, Sean DeCrane has really worked hard and put a lot of time into the code process, and was omnipresent at the code hearings almost on every code change proposal. He was up there giving comments. But the thing I don't think that we recognized was how critical it was going to be after the Minnesota vote for sprinklers to the involvement in the legislative process. And National Association of Home Builders clearly went to legislatures and influenced changes that would affect how codes could be adopted. So that's something, and you mentioned it, that we're going to have to be aware of, and you know, that takes some political lobbying and relationships and more coalitions.
Right. So in one sense, Mike, all of the strategies operate independently. You know, different players step up to the plate and say, I'll provide some leadership, but it's still a partnership. It's still a collaborative effort. And in some cases, you know, partners are going to agree on what's important, and others they're not. And if the system works the way that we have been basically modeling it to work, that is, where we can agree, let's work together. And if we don't agree, let's not have that be the end of the world. I'll do my thing, you do your thing, and we'll move forward. My evolutionary thought on this whole process has been the United States is a different picture. The fire administration is in a great position to provide leadership on a lot of these issues, and they have very limited resources to do so. So at the end of the day, we're still trying to figure out, you know, how the fire administration can provide support and leadership where the grant programs come in. And at the end of the day, it's going to be different people stepping up to the plate and saying, I'm going to be willing to put energy and resources in this direction for the collective good. Hopefully that works out. There is one final piece that's not a strategy, if you guys are willing and we have time to talk about the model performance measures.
We really don't have to. We don't have a lot of time here, so I can just give a quick overview, and what we can do is do that on a future show.
Well, it might be worth it on a future show, Ed, but if people stay tuned to the website, www.strategicfire.org, they'll learn more about the model performance measures that we have developed and more about the efforts to get the word out. We conducted a national webinar on that topic, and it is going to be part of our a symposium in June. So there's significant progress on that one as well. I guess I'll leave it at that.
All right. And we definitely will bring you back for an update on that on the on a future show here, because I know that a lot you have done a lot of work in that area. So, well, Jim, boy, there is a lot happening with Vision 2020. This has really grown quite a bit from, what, 3 years now, I guess?
Right.
It's been in play. So,
yeah.
You know, hats off to you and to all the other people that are involved with it, because I know, like you said, it's a collaborative effort of people across the nation just really coming together to contribute to this. And it's quite the who's who of people in fire safety that are a part of this really important project.
So, well, I appreciate that, Ed. Your role, Mike's role in this whole thing, it's a collective effort, and I mean that from the heart. It's people recognizing that if we put energy in a positive direction and we're willing to work together, we can get a lot done. And I'm pleased to say that the original fear about, yeah, it'll be just another plan that sits on the shelf isn't what's happening.
Well, we've been talking with Jim Crawford, who's the project manager of Vision 2020, giving us an update on it. And there will be a lot more information on the webpage. If you look below, you'll see some links to the Vision 2020 website, which is strategicfire.org. And as I said, you know, we'll have Jim back again in the future to give us more updates as this goes along. So thanks for joining us, Jim.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Well, Mike, I think we had a pretty good show there with a lot of information packed in there in a short period of time.
Well, and certainly the whole area of fire safety and the environment is something that's evolving, and you know, we all have to keep an eye on it. I'm glad we were able to get something out there on the podcast.
And as with all of our shows, you know, there's going to be a lot more information on this on the website. If you look down, you'll see links to various articles with more information that you can, you know, or organizations that have more information. And we're certainly going to be following this in the future. I mean, all three topics, the grant, we're going to keep you up to date with what's going on in the Senate. The environment issue, that's just an evolving one, and certainly Vision 2020. There's just going to be a lot happening in there. So I'd like to wrap the show, and I'd like to, again, thank Mike for joining us as co-host on Fire Marshal's Corner. Thanks for coming, Mike.
Thank you, and I look forward to it.
Okay, my name is Ed Kamau.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.